I'm Charlotte. My pronouns are she, her. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Avon McMaster. This is Demythifying, the podcast where usually two best friends talk mythology, go off on tangents, and hope to bring a little bit more forgotten magic to the world. So, hi, Avon. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me on. It's an absolute pleasure.
Before we kick off with the Romans, please can you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself?
Sure. So I did a PhD in classics at the University of Toronto back a long time ago. Maybe not that long ago, but anything before the pandemic feels essentially 3 or 4 centuries ago at this point. And then I became a professor at a university in Northern Ontario, Canada, for about 15 years, where I taught. My specialty was Latin poetry when I was doing my research, Latin poetry and social history, but it was in a small department, which means you teach a lot of stuff. There were only 3 full-time faculty. You cover a lot of different topics, but I focused on Roman and Latin material and language. And then a couple of years ago, due to financial issues at my university, the classics program and the department and the small section of the university I was at were all closed. And I have moved into a new non-academic career as a result. So I'm now a federal government employee in Canada, in which I do nothing to do with my topic, except there is a little bit of intersectional analysis based on gender and sexuality and other identities that is a framework that they're trying to implement across the government for thinking about the implementation of programs. And I only bring that up because it was quite astonishing to me. I didn't expect to find anything that I was good at in this new job, essentially. And when I saw it, I thought, all right, that is something I'm going to pursue because I know the words in that. I'm going to keep going. And none of them is a government acronym. So that is the one piece of overlap with my old job.
Well, it's good that you found something.
Yeah, no, and it's great. It's actually really nice to have a little piece of expertise in a bit of my old job. I also am a co-host of a podcast and work with my husband on videos on etymology and word history.
What drew you so much to the classics?
It goes very far back with me. The family legend is that when we were on vacation when I was 7, we went to Europe and brought almost no reading material, and I was a big reader, and so I read the only books in English that were with us, and that included, my mom had brought the Greek myths 1 and 2 by Robert Graves, and she'd brought that, Carl Jung, and the Bible, and the complete works of Shakespeare, because she thought this was her opportunity to do the reading. She never did. She actually ended up buying Agatha Christie's in every store she went into, and that's what she read the entire time. But I read the Greek myths. So the story goes that ever since then, I was interested in the ancient world. And we all know the flaws of basing your entire interest in the ancient world on Robert Graves. But as an intro, as a storyteller, he's pretty good. And I didn't read the footnotes, which was probably all the best, all to the good. In more real terms, and also leaving aside a very bad cartoon of Hercules from the 70s that I watched a lot as a child that I'm fairly certain was also important. My real interests all the way through school were in language and literature. So I liked, you know, English class and language. And when I went to high school, I was at the only public high school in Ottawa, or one of 2 public high schools in Ottawa that offered Latin, and in fact offered a little bit of ancient Greek. And I took them because that sounded cool and I was interested in languages and I just loved it and I kept going with it. And so it's not that common in Canada to do languages in high school before university. Not that many places have it, not in my generation and since, but I had that opportunity. And basically when I was thinking about university, what I was really interested in was literature, but English programs seemed really mainstream, so I wanted to be different, so I applied for classics. And I started as a classics undergrad, which is actually quite unusual here. Again, like most students that I taught didn't come in for classics, but found it in the university, because most students don't even know it exists really here. But I came in knowing that's what I wanted to do. I did an undergrad, and once you've started down that path, I mean, where else are you going to go with it? So I just kept going. But poetry was always my first love, and so it's no surprise that I ended up in Latin poetry as my main interest.
I definitely think your mum was right to go and get the Agatha Christies, because that's definitely holiday reading. But it's incredible that this is the story your family are telling you of how you got into the classics.
We have made our own little myth about the story. The other part of that story, by the way, is that the only thing she did read of what she brought was the Carl Jung, and then she had really weird dreams the entirety of the vacation. We were there for 6 months in Europe, so we were she had a lot of time to get very bored and actually get to some of that reading. As did I.
Well, I was looking at the subjects on your link when I contacted you about what you're interested in and what you can talk about. And one subject that I read you know a lot about is sexual politics in ancient times. So what is sexual politics, and why should we want to know about it in Roman times?
Well, if you think about politics at its most basic, it's about the study of power relationships. You know, I don't mean government, but you know, politics as a real sort of part of life is really about power relations. And so sexual politics is the study of sexual power relations, really, if you want to put it that way. How do people relate to one another within the context of sex? And I think that's a particularly apt way of thinking about Roman sexuality and ancient sexuality in general, but to focus on Roman, though I'm perfectly able to talk a bit about Greece. Rome is always my specialty, because Rome is very explicit as well as having a lot of implicit power relations in sex. So sexual activity, as well as gender relations, as well as sexual sort of ideology, are really, really strongly focused about the relationships of power between the people who are interacting. And so that's a useful way to think about it. And then you can expand beyond that to think about how does that, politics is also essentially a study of society, then, you know, sex and society is a larger version of that.
And how do we know so much about their concept of sexuality, gender, and identity? Is that purely from the literature that we found?
It's from a variety of sources. Obviously, we have, compared to many other places and times, a lot of literature from the Roman period. And when I say the Roman period, talking about a long period of time, one of the things about this kind of study is we do tend to, if we're not careful, we collapse things from the beginning of the Republican period down to the end of the, you know, to the fall of the Roman Empire and call it Rome. And that's 1,000 years. That's a lot of difference, right? That's like saying that our sexual identities and politics are the same from now to 1000 AD. And obviously they've changed a bit. So, you know, that's a little bit of a difficulty. But at the same time, what we have is a fair amount of literature that is itself fairly obsessed with the question of sex, which is helpful. Some of it, like poetry, like Latin love elegy, you know, talks about sex pretty openly. We also have invective is another really good source for our understanding of sex. So that is really when we're talking about rhetoric, law speeches, and political speeches. And because we have Cicero, we have a lot of that, and some other people too, and stuff that's preserved in histories, the sort of speeches people gave, because and I think maybe we can talk about this more in a bit, a big focus often of attacks on people was attacks on their sexual behavior. And all of these sources are complicated sources. They're not just telling us this is exactly how the world worked, but they are telling us nonetheless about a lot of things. And then we also have a large amount of legal material. And legal material is about prescribing how people act. And while sex wasn't and sexuality were not a topic that the law considered important, like the state didn't consider it important until the Augustan period, really until the end of the Republic, it was a personal matter rather than a state matter. After Augustus, it becomes more and more regulated. And even before that, it gets touched on in places that can give us some help. And then there are other kinds of sources like art, right? Wall paintings and statues obviously give us some sort of idea of how the body was treated, and other kinds of material culture. There's an amazing knife from, I think it's from Britain, that has a knife handle of like four people having sex in these really complicated forms, shall we say, you know, things like that, the famous many penises of Pompeii, that kind of stuff, that give us other avenues to look at how these things worked. But obviously literature is always going to be a big part of it. It also really helps that we have some really gossipy historical sources, like Suetonius, for instance. And all he ever wants to do is talk about sex. So that's helpful.
I'm just imagining someone taking the time to carve four people having sex onto a knife.
Mm-hmm. And it must have been quite an expensive one. I think it's a horn, you know, like the material is horn, if I'm remembering it correctly. This is a half-remembered thing, so I don't want to be held to it. But yeah. Oh, yeah. Very intricate carving and activities.
When we spoke to Anna Cargill-Martin about Messalina, a point that she made was that rumours and propaganda that come about in certain times, like ancient times, for example, can tell us almost as much about the society as the facts. Do you think this is true?
Yes. I mean, especially because being the kind of person I am, I would immediately ask you what you meant by facts in opposition to rumor and innuendo and all those things, especially when we're talking about the past. But frankly, even right now, you know, the facts are really hard to come by and pin down in a helpful way. Now, obviously, there's things that we believe might have actually happened, and then there's things that we're pretty sure didn't. But even the things that we're pretty sure didn't happen, I definitely think that they tell us an awful lot. So what, you know, when I study Latin literature and Latin poetry, I am not studying it because I think that the poets are telling me what their day was like. Among other things, my mother is a published poet, and boy, oh boy, is her poetry not what her day was like. You know, I have a really close at hand example of what literature is, which is not a blow-by-blow account of everyday life. So I would never take it as meaning that. But everything that a poet tells you, or that Cicero says when he's saying something horrible about Antony, tells you about the expectations of the audience, what they think is normal, what they think is not normal, what they think is good or bad, because there's no point in attacking somebody with a piece of invective if everybody in the audience is like, well, yeah, that sounds like a pretty okay thing to do, actually. Why is that? Like, that's not going to get you very far. And we have to take on faith that when Catullus writes invective poetry, his audience thought it was pretty nasty. But I think we can, you know, there's some assumptions we can make. And so I think that that tells you an awful, because really, if all we knew was what Romans actually did, imagine we could know that, which we can't. But if we could know it, how boring would that be? Surely what we want to know is why they did what they did, what they thought of the things they did, and most importantly, what they thought of other people when they did those things. That's the only thing that actually matters to me about the ancient world. As you might be able to tell, I'm not a historian by nature. I might have colleagues who would disagree with me on some of that, but
I think it's also very rarely, if at all, when we're watching a soap opera, for example, do you see someone boil a kettle or make a cup of coffee from scratch, from getting the mug out to the, you know, and it's because
how often do people go to the bathroom?
Yeah, and it's those little details that we have in our day-to-day lives. We have multiples of those throughout our day that are not in our art.
Yes,
because we don't need to see that. We live that.
And that, of course, is the frustrating thing about trying to use something like literature or history to reconstruct the past, because nobody, you know, how many shows could you watch before you found out that it's normal in a UK kitchen to have an electric kettle and that it's not normal in an American kitchen to have an electric kettle? You would have to watch a lot of sitcoms to find that out. Now, you watch Coronation Street, you might find it out within 5 minutes. But almost anything else, you wouldn't know that. And yet that's a very true thing, you know, but you'll never know it. And in the same way, a Roman isn't going to tell us about boring stuff that everybody knows, because it's boring and everybody knows it. They'll only tell us about the unusual things. And when it comes to sexuality, that is a problem because people are going to tell us about the weird, the unusual, the scary, the scandalous, the titillating. They aren't going to tell us the equivalent of, I have sex 2.5 times a week with my wife and mostly in missionary. You know?
Yeah, and it's perfectly
lovely. It's not
going to
make it into anything.
You know, it's perfectly lovely and we have a lovely time and then we
Yeah, and it's fine. And like sometimes it's great and sometimes it's not. And we have a few kids and life's kind of normal, right? That's not going to be written down anywhere. No one is ever going to write that. And there's no Kinsey report for the ancient world. So, so we have to kind of reconstruct norms from the extraordinary. But that's true, frankly, of every facet of the ancient world. We're always reconstructing the norm from the extraordinary.
Generally, in this day and age, we know of a few strong female figures. You know, we know the warrior queen Boudica, Emperor Constantine's mother Helena, and Livia, Augustus's wife. But what do you think happened to the other women who helped mold Rome? Is that in stuff that we've just lost? Or do you think people didn't find them interesting enough to write about?
There's a lot of different reasons. Now, the first thing I'll say is we actually do know, if I use the royal scholarly we actually do know more than I think many people might think we know about Roman women. So for one thing, there wasn't quite the same culture of impropriety around speaking of a woman by name that there was, for instance, at Athens. So when we're looking at Greek history, it can be really tough because this rudeness associated with a woman being spoken of by name in public. And that extends even to literature in certain contexts anyway. That, it's not that that's completely absent, but it's not really as big a feature in the Roman world. So it is quite common, especially for upper class women, to be mentioned by name in histories and other contexts because they reflect on the glory of their family as much as the men do, even if they have to do it in a different way. So we actually know more than you might think. At the same time, we certainly don't know nearly as many famous women or important women as we know famous and important men. There's no question about that. You know, there's the obvious answers there are, you know, patriarchy. So we'll just take that as read. But we have a decent amount also of evidence, limited evidence, but evidence like funerary inscriptions and inscriptions on during the period when everyone at Rome was carving something into stone every other moment, it seems. There are a lot of inscriptions in the late Republic and early Empire that are of women as benefactors, for instance, like in not at Rome, but across the Roman Empire more, who set up temples or buildings or put some games on or things like that. So like there are the kind of middling level, like not famous enough to make it into the histories or important enough to make it into the big stories, but clearly important in their local context with or without a husband involved or a brother or a father, you know, without a man. There's a decent amount of them. Now we don't know their whole stories. We'll get one inscription, for instance, or something like that. But, you know, that's more than you might think. But that said, there was a basic assumption that the role of a woman, that there was a role for women in shaping Rome, but that role was to be an influencer rather than an active participant in public life. So in that sense, we're going to have, you know, the sort of cliche of the strong woman behind the scenes, the woman who causes her menfolk to act in a particular way or does things. And that certainly happened, and we're going to not have that written down. And there is certainly a women aren't very interesting unless they're exceptional assumption. Now, they didn't think men were terribly interesting unless they were exceptional, but there were a lot more ways for a man to be exceptional and successful as opposed to exceptional and punished for it, I think. So, you know, I think the imperial woman in particular, once you get into the empire, we hear a lot about members of the imperial, female members of the imperial family. Fairly frequently it's negative, but then to be fair, there's a lot of negatives about the emperors too.
And
the men don't always come out great either.
They were all just getting up to mischief, weren't
yeah.
they?
All
of them, they were shagging and a killing.
Yeah, exactly.
And what about the everyday woman? Is that because it's more implied that they just crack on behind scenes?
Yeah, and I mean, frankly, we don't have a lot of everyday men either. We just, everyday people aren't interesting. We have, you know, 99.9% of Romans who ever lived, we know nothing about. Because why would we? Even when we have relatively full information about, you know, census data and all sorts of, you know, more than we could possibly hope to have from many other places and times, that still is only capturing people with land and who are full Roman citizens and who, you know, have enough money to be counted and allowed to enroll in the army or whatever. And then we're not hearing about the women. So I think we don't, but again, we do have, you know, evidence of women shop owners and women who were merchants and things like that. So we have some, but what we have is piecemeal, I think. I think what we don't have is the information about, you know, a individual woman's life in any kind of way that could be a narrative. Not for any women, but for everyday women, we don't really have that kind of a narrative. And so, you know, if it's not a story, it doesn't get the play, even
it's for a modern audience. It's not the whole picture of one particular everyday woman or everyday man. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. You can piece it together. People do statistical stuff and put together a bunch of stuff and can say, okay, well, a typical Roman woman of this class might have this kind of a life, which is very good and interesting, but it's this woman. And it's this person who had this life exactly. It's more a sort of a widespread thing.
Is there a figure who may be female, maybe who we'd now call non-binary, that you think often gets overlooked and you'd like people to know more about?
I think there are a number. It sort of depends. It depends how much of a nerd for such things you are, how overlooked they are. I'm going to say a name that some people listening are going to be like, are you kidding me? She is so famous. What is your problem? And then other people are going to have never heard of. But one of the women from the ancient world whom I just have a really strong affection for, in spite of the fact she was almost certainly terrible to actually know and live with, is Fulvia.
Okay.
Fulvia was, well, she was so many things. She was the wife of a lot of people, but that's not by any means the only thing she was. So she was the wife of a man called Curio, who was, well, let me restrict it to the things that people care about. But Curio was at one point a henchman sort of Julius Caesar. She was, and then he was killed and in a violent clash in the city. Then, and much more importantly, she was a wife of Mark Antony. And Mark Antony had multiple wives, but she was the wife of Mark Antony, who, when Mark Antony was off in the East, conducted a war, part of the civil war in Italy on his behalf, along with his brother, against Octavian. This is the civil war period. All the civil war periods are really complicated, and I'm not going to get into the history of why Mark, like, this is not the main civil war. This is well before that. But briefly, Fulvia was in Italy and there was conflict between Antony and Octavian, and she ended up essentially going to war against Octavian. And it's unclear how much she actually led the troops, but to some degree she did. Enough so that we have, for instance, sling bullets. So one of the things that you fought with was men would use a slingshot, right? And that they'd have these little bullets before there were guns, they were called bullets, which were little bits of lead. And because you'd shoot them, so it was shot and kill people with it. But because they were lead, it's very easy to carve on them. And so one of the things that soldiers would often do is carve little messages on these little bullets that were basically like curses or taunts or insults. And so there was one particular siege where she was besieging a town and we found these siege bullets, and they're all things like, please excuse the following profanity, Fulvia sucks dick. Fulvia, suck my cock. I'm putting it up your ass, Fulvia. You know, that kind of thing.
And there were things, how big were these bullets to have?
Not very big, but you can get a lot in if you use the right
terminology. Yeah.
Latin is very concise. It's one of its, and has a surprising number of specific vocabulary for specific sex acts too, which helps. But we can tell. In other words, she was considered the commander of the army as far as these soldiers were concerned. So they were attacking her and they were using this sexualized vocabulary, which was not unusual for soldiers in general, but I'm sure was in part because it was a woman, of course. Anyway, she has various other exploits, but she's also the one thing she's probably the most famous for is she was still Mark Antony's wife when Cicero was, or it was before this, when they were doing those prescriptions. After Julius Caesar died, the people who took over after him, Antony and Octavian and Lepidus, nobody cares about Lepidus, made a list of their enemies and said, essentially, anyone who kills any of these people can do it for, they're allowed, they won't be punished, plus they'll get half of their estate. And they published these lists. And one of the names on that list was Cicero. And specifically was because Cicero had made these speeches against Antony and been a big enemy of his and been really insulting to him. And Fulvia apparently was really angry, both on Antony's behalf and on her own, because she was mentioned not terribly flatteringly in said speeches. And so Cicero makes it on the list. And when he was killed, his head and hands were brought back to her. And the story goes, she went to the rostra in the forum where he'd normally given his speeches, the speaker's place, and put his head and his hands there and stabbed them with her hat pin, which is not a thing, but her pins, her brooches, and was like, and you know, that's through his tongue and his hands, because those are the things with which she had harmed his. And Cicero had also been an enemy of several of her previous husbands too, that I won't get into because that gets really complicated. So as I said, not a comfortable woman, probably not a nice woman, but boy, interesting woman, and someone who you want a strong woman. Like she was a force in her own right. She just kept marrying these people who were shit disturbers and top of the power heap, and she was just a force to be reckoned with. And then she died in we don't know. We know at some point she died, but we don't know anything about that. But we know that, well, she lived. She was really interesting.
I'm going to look into her. I don't think I've heard of her before.
Yeah. I think that Fulvia, I don't know if you've seen the show Rome, the HBO show Rome.
I've seen bits of it.
Yeah. I have always felt that the mother of, for those who have seen it, that the mother of Octavian as produced in that show, who is a complete slander on the actual mother of Octavian, who, as far as we know, was a completely blameless, perfectly normal woman who didn't do anything terrible. But Atia in that show does all these terrible things. And I've always thought that the writers combined Fulvia and then Lesbia from Catullus's poetry and put those two people together into her character. And that's who they based her on. I don't know that for sure, but it's, especially because she ends up with, you know, she's a lover of Antony and Antony doesn't have a wife in that show. So that's my pet theory.
It sounds like they took loads of different sources to sex up this character who probably, you know, like we said before, perfectly normal, but that's boring. So
yeah, no, absolutely. Rome has to have, everybody has to be a monster and, you know, extraordinary person. So they've taken all these things, but I think you can find models, at least in the gossip, for a lot of what they put in that show in the stories that we have told of women like Fulvia who defy gender expectations, do things they're not supposed to do, and therefore are lurid and sensational, and people write the most extraordinary stories about them.
You've touched on this briefly already, but what can the literature and the art of the time tell us the thoughts and opinions of the role of sexual politics at this time? Or is it all skewed because we're not really going to know?
Well, it's all skewed and we're not really going to know. But also, I think it really can. I mean, I think, as I've said before, I think when you hear people, I gravitate towards the insults, frankly, the insulting stuff, because the insulting stuff is only insulting if there's a norm against which it plays. So, you know, in our modern world, if you call somebody unmanly, which I don't think people I'm friends with would do, but you know, if one uses that term and then goes on to list a number of things they do that are unmanly, that tells you what that person's perception of manly is, because you can do a pretty straightforward reversal each of them and say, okay, well, a manly person in that person's viewpoint does not do, doesn't, you know, cook and look after kids and cry or whatever the particular stereotype is. Now, does that tell you that no man that person has never seen a man do any of those things? And, you know, no, it's much fuzzier than that, but it does tell you something about their norms. And so I tend to look at the invective because it helps a lot. And then also you get other stuff, which is clearly idealizing, but ideals also help. They don't, again, tell you exactly what happened. But I think if you use a sensible filter and think to yourself, well, if I saw this equivalent on a TV show now, I would know what the gap, the sort of the likelihood of the distance of the gap between that and real life was. And I might not get that calibration quite right when I look at the ancient world, but if I'm sensible about genre and I think a bit about some of the physical limitations of actual real life, for instance, and how likely it is that that person accused of self-filleting himself actually did so, you know.
Yeah.
If I work through a few logical pieces of information, I can make a pretty good analog to how seriously I should take this piece of information and what it can tell me about the world. And I think we can really do that. Certainly, that's how I look at ancient literature and at the sources we have.
And talking about the sources, I'd like to talk to you about Ovid, who is mm-hmm. one of my faves. And then later, I've got a couple of questions on Catullus, who is another one of my faves.
With you on both, yeah.
Being all emo at 15, I thought Ovid and Catullus were fantastic.
So. Yeah.
Ovid is someone who is seen as being, you know, having been sympathetic towards women, you know, despite a modern eye noticing the obvious sexual violence.
Mm-hmm.
And I read an article while researching for this, that for this episode, that was written by Mary Beard, and she questions whether Ovid is celebrating sexual violence or exposing it. What is your opinion? And it's opinion, because again...
Oh yeah, no, it's definitely opinion. And Ovid is so slippery. You know, there's a million opinions about Ovid because, among other things, we just have so much of him. And in some ways, it could be much easier to pin down someone like Catullus when there's a sort of limited corpus and you can kind of exhaustively argue about every single line of it. Ovid kind of defies that because there's just so much of his writing that survives. My answers when asked about most Roman authors, poets, tend to be frustratingly why not both-esque. So, yeah. But I think with Ovid Ovid is a complicated man. I think personally that Ovid is empathetic as a basic state. And what I mean by empathetic is not sympathetic, but that he understands and feels and is interested in portraying strong emotion. And he's really good at it too. He's really good at depicting strong emotion. And in particular, if you're looking at the Metamorphoses, which is certainly where a lot of people go when they say Ovid, a lot of people mean that. Understandably, it's huge and important. He focuses the stories around strong emotions. And I think personally that he is most of the time pretty agnostic about right, what's right. I don't think you can look at the Met and say that he has a consistent point of view about who is in the right or wrong under the circumstances that there is sexual violence. So that is, you know, let's assume there's a sexual violence that we think we know what Ovid's opinion is on it. I don't think he's consistent. I think you can definitely find stories of women as victims where there is a strong, sympathetic portrayal of the woman as having been harmed in ways that are both physical and emotional, and that we can see the consequences, the emotional and mental consequences of violence, where the aggressors are definitely condemned, sometimes very explicitly, sometimes just in the way that they're portrayed, sometimes they're made fun of. But you can definitely find lots that are focused on the aggressors, where the aggressor's point of view is what we see, where we see the victim as sexually appealing because of their fear, because of their victimization, which is certainly something that, if not glorifying sexual violence, is turning it into entertainment. And I think that's the key, right? I think he likes to tell stories that have a high emotional content. He wants to show stakes. Yeah. He wants to show that. So to that extent, yes, he's celebrating it in that he is making entertainment out of it.
Provoke a reaction, yeah, as well.
So he's doing something that, like, I would say I don't want to do in my life, which as a personal choice, I don't want to take a story of sexual violence and make it entertaining. And he does that over and over and over and over again. Now, is that celebrating it in the sense of saying, hey, Roman, go out and do this. This is a good thing and a way to live your life. I don't think so on the regular in the Met. However, take a step back to the Ars Amatoria or the Amores, and you can definitely find places in those works, the Ars Amatoria being the essentially the manual on how to pick up and keep and dump girls, and then the Amores being his love poems. In those two sets of work, you can certainly find poems that absolutely say this is the literally and explicitly no doesn't mean no. She says no, but keep going and then she'll be happy. Hey, last night I had a great time with my girl. She fought me off, but there's not that many bruises on her and her clothes are barely torn and she totally dug it, right? Like those are two sections that he has. And if that's not celebrating sexual violence, I don't know what is. Does that mean that he actually did any of that in real life? That's something I'm agnostic on. I have no idea what Ovid did in real life. And I don't think that a poem is an admission of guilt, but I also obviously don't think it's an exoneration either. I have no idea what he did in real life, but so I think he's complicated and I think he's inconsistent. And I think trying to pull out a consistent stance or a consistent message when it comes to what he considers right and valuable, I think it's a fool's game. I think you can't do it.
Yeah, it's kind of grim listening to that now, but maybe at the time, it's a whole different mentality. We can't always view the same thing with a modern lens because...
Well, and I mean, that story of she says no, but she really wants it. I mean, there are 90s sitcoms with exactly that storyline. So let's not take too far a step back in terms... There are... rom-coms now where stalk 'em till she says yes is still the basic underlying view. Not, you know, and leaving aside people who are terrible, awful human beings who are out there and are willing to do lots of them, but just like talking mainstream. So it's not not particularly surprising that we would see that in him. And there's more and there's elements that add to that violence, that one of those poems is also about an enslaved woman. So, you know, there's elements of stuff, which is not good. Not excusing any of that. It's not good. Just that, no, I don't think it's surprising. And I think looking for, you know, seeing something like the Heroides, where he speaks in the voice of wronged women and has all these poems that are letters written supposedly by these wronged women of myth, telling the men that in their lives that they're horrible human beings. You read those poems and you're like, oh my goodness, he's totally on the side of women. But I think really he likes the exceptional. He likes the unusual. He wants to tell stories of paradox and of surprise and of people breaking with expectations. And what better way to do that than to be sympathetic to wronged women, who, like someone like Medea, who's always the bad girl of myth, make her the heroine who's wronged, is a more interesting story. And I think that like, again, it's so much of this is about genre, thinking about what's the framework of this story and why would he choose these stories, rather than thinking, oh, he's a proto-feminist. Not that I'm suggesting that either you or Mary Beard said that, but yeah, you know, that line of thinking that like, really, he's secretly deeply sympathetic to women. I'm not sure of that.
Do you think that's why, you know, there are some ideas where he writes women who defy stereotypes? We have Echo, we have Symmachus, we have Mira, and they take on the role of the pursuer or in some cases the rapist.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think what we're seeing there is that focus, especially in the Metamorphoses. Like that's where those stories, he wants the exotic. He wants the paradox. You know, the story of Iphis, for instance, which is one that is celebrated as the story of a what we would call a trans person, and then a transition, magically aided by the gods. And I really, really not trying to diminish that as that story. It's an extremely important story for many people that it exists, that this story is told, that it has a sympathetic portrayal. I'm not trying to diminish that at all. But at the same time, what is it? It's a paradox. It's a, you know, it's a portrayal of an impossibility that becomes possible through a transformation. Well, that's what the Met is. That's a, it's a whole bunch of stories. It's 15 books of paradoxes and surprises, defying expectations, the exotic, the bizarre, and then the transformation that accompanies it. So I don't think, I mean, we can also find lots of stories where he depicts men acting against type, right? The focus, understandably, is on how many times we see women do that, because we're so not used to seeing women in our ancient literature that we focus on it, and which we should. But also, you know, I think really he does that all the time with, I mean, he has dolphins acting against type too. Right? Like, he's just interested in things that are weird and bizarre. So, yeah.
I have one more question about Ovid, because I was curious about your take on this. So there are two schools of thought relating to Medusa and Minerva's punishment of her. So one is, obviously, Minerva is offended that Medusa gets violated by Poseidon in her temple. Mm-hmm. And another is that Minerva is protecting her by turning her into something hideous that can turn men into stone. You know, we've got the line, across the fields and along the tracks, he had seen the statues of men and beasts transformed to stone at the sight of Medusa. And is Minerva protecting her here so that men and boys can't get close to her? Because it's not women or girls that are being turned into stone. It's people who potentially could do her harm, the men, the boys. What do you think? I don't necessarily think so. It was just something I found. And
It's a fraught topic, the Medusa topic. You just have to say her name on any form of like TikTok or YouTube or whatever to get people they are ready to jump on that topic. I'm afraid I'm rather boring on the subject. Ovid says very little. And if we're focused on Ovid, he says two, you know, he has that line that you mentioned. And then when he actually talks about her, he really, I think in the passage, in the, you know, the lines when he says she was violated, the Poseidon violated her in the temple of Minerva. Minerva turned her face away and hid her face behind the shield of Zeus. And then it says, Newe hoc impune fuisset, so, you know, so that this would not happen without punishment, impune. She turned the hair of the Gorgon into terrible snakes. And that's it. That's the entire intent we get. That's all the intent that we then get, the result of that, which is that now, now, once that her head was cut off, so that she could terrify her enemies, she put her head onto her breastplate. That's Minerva put Medusa's head onto her breastplate. But that doesn't tell us anything about why she did this to the Gorgon in the first place. And Ovid specifically is focused on the hair, because just before that he'd said Medusa had the most beautiful hair in the entire world. And so that's why he turns her hair to snakes, because it takes the thing that was beautiful and turns it ugly. And that's it. That's all we got. And I think reading that line, I'm a very boring textual focused person. I was raised, I always say raised about my graduate training. I feel like it's I was raised as a very old-fashioned philologist who just goes back to the text. I've moved a little past it, but that's still my instinct. And looking at that, we just have impune. It's just so that she'd not be unpunished. And that is a theme through all of the Metamorphoses, that the gods get really annoyed when their prerogative is in any way trod upon. When they feel themselves disrespected, they punish. That's what they do. And so in that sense, I think it matches perfectly. And that other line, just to say that he saw through the street, through the roads, perco vidis hominum simulacra ferrarumque in silicem. that had been turned in by Medusa. So he saw through the roads the images of hominum and ferrarum. That just is homines, which is the general term for humans. It's not actually men. It's not wieri. It's humans. Now, all the translators translated as men.
As men, yeah.
Because of course they do. Frankly.
Is that because it's an easy translate?
It's an easy translate. And I mean, homines is certainly used in the way that men was used for a very long time as the general term for humans, right? All mankind, like mankind or just men. It's the non-marked, right? It means persons, people, but in a very general way. Certainly can mean males, but it isn't exclusive to them. And then ferrarum is just of wild beasts. But that combination, to get really nerdy for a moment here, humans and beasts, you know, the three categories of things in the world are gods, humans, and beasts. And gods are not going to get turned to stone. So humans and beasts covers all the animate things in the world. Yeah. And that combination suggests to me that what he means to show us there is that, like, her power is such that she can turn anything into stone. So the way I read it is that there is no emphasis on it being males that she converts. Now, that said, I'm aware there's an entire industry of fiction based on the assumption that that is not the correct reading of that line. And I am not here to invalidate those interpretations. I think that's I don't think there's anything in those lines that makes that an impossible interpretation. I just don't think it's particularly there in the text, but it's not ruled out. So I'm fine with that interpretation. It's not, I don't think that it's what Ovid meant, which is not the same as it's not what you can read in that text. I don't think it was his emphasis. That's my view. It was a long way of saying I think it was a punishment.
I mean, it's nice that there are these people that take it that way and write novels, because they're doing their own interpretations of the myths. And
myth, let me be really clear here, that is what myth is for. Like, and I mean that on a really deep academic level. The purpose of myth is to tell stories about the world around you today that make you function in the world as a human. You know, like, that's what myth is for. And so you do, like, Ovid does not own the myth of Medusa, any kind of authority even. You do whatever the hell you want with Medusa, and I'm here for it. But if you ask me what I think Ovid was saying, that's my interpretation.
And talking about myths, why do you think so many myths involve elements of, say, for example, Zeus transforming into another being to ravish, and I say that in air quotes,
you know,
we have him turning into a swan with Leda, a golden shower with Danae, for example. Do you think this is to make things a bit more palatable for the audiences?
No, I don't think that's why.
Okay.
Would be my answer. I think I have three reasons why I think that's true. There are more, but I'll go with three. One, an awful lot of these stories we know from Ovid. Ovid is one of our biggest sources for Greek myth, even though he's not Greek and not actually doing myth anymore. But Ovid's source is called the Metamorphoses. And every story in the Metamorphoses has a metamorphosis. Yeah. So he is either going to choose stories that have metamorphoses in them, or he is going to use the version of, or even change the story so it has one. So it's a bit of a chicken and an egg problem. Why do we have so many stories about transformation, especially when it comes to sexual? Well, I already talked about why I think there's so much sexual violence in this, in his poems. And why are there so many more metamorphoses? Well, because we have our main source, not our only by any means, but like one of our major sources for developed stories is from a poem about metamorphoses. So that's one. I think another one that comes back a little bit more to sort of why does myth exist and why is it the form it is that one of the main, there are a couple of reasons, there are a couple of reasons myth exists, and that is a level of certainty that I do not feel comfortable saying, so I'm going to revise that.
Okay.
Some of the ways that myth comes about, some of the reasons that myths exist are etiology, so explaining the origins of things, right? Myths exist to explain why the sky is blue, why roses are red, whatever. Mm-hmm. And so it is very, very common for myths to have an element of transformation in them because they, they explain why the animal, why is the minotaur, that's not a good one, but, why do certain things exist in the world? Well, because a god was a particular shape when he engendered it, for instance. So that's one reason that you might have like these animal stories and things like that. Another that's connected to that as well is about ritual being an important source of some myth. And so reflection of ritual into myth, and when rituals involve animals or involve particular springs or whatever, that stuff's going to be worked into myth. And so again, for the origin story of that ritual, you're going to say, well, they worship bulls on Crete because Zeus arrived on Crete in the shape of a bull carrying Europa. And what's actually going on there is they worship the bulls and then they make up the story about Zeus, not the other way around, but the story is the other way around.
Retrospectively.
Yeah, yeah. And so I think that's another reason why we have a lot of those stories. But I think to get to the heart of the question you asked, I don't think that the animals, that Zeus doing these acts of sexual violence as an animal makes it more palatable. I think it makes it more interesting. Because I think, and I'm sorry to say this, but I think that coerced sex is normal enough in the ancient world that it's not very interesting. That is not me saying that people in the ancient world went around raping all the time and that there was no punishments for it or anything like that. That is very much not true. It was considered a violent act and a crime under certain circumstances and a terrible crime. But it also was not uncommon in certain situations. So enslaved people, people without social standing, certain kinds of sex that we would consider coercion that they did not consider coercion, like within marriage or young children, things like that. So I don't think that a story about Zeus coming down and having even coerced sex with a woman is a very interesting story. But it is interesting if he happens to be a bull at the time. I think for Ovid, for instance, telling these stories, they're more interesting and titillating and funny and weird if it's a swan than if it's just a guy. So I don't actually think it's to be palatable. I think it's to make it more interesting.
Yeah, and I think you're correct then. Like we were saying about, films in the 90s, it's not that long mm-hmm. ago where, rape within marriage wasn't rape.
No, and you can still have problems convincing a court that it is in many places in this world right now. So yeah, there's, certain, that's why I say certain kinds of coerced sex were not unusual. Others were considered terrible, but the context mattered.
Moving on to Catullus. Mm-hmm. Does the fact that Catullus wrote for a largely upper class audience change how we should perceive his work in regards to gender politics? We know that the structure of Roman society was based upon either wealth or lack of wealth regarding which classes people fell into. Does that change mm-hmm. anything when we read his work?
I mean, yes and no. It is a feature that we absolutely must be aware of. He is an elite man writing for an elite audience. Roman society is based on wealth, but also on class and birth. Does obviously go hand in hand, though not always, but he was both wealthy and of elite birth, and he is writing for mostly people of the same, though there's a little bit more mobility in Rome than we sometimes think there is. But at the same time, all of our sources are the same, right? We have almost no sources from the ancient world that are not elite men writing for elite men. On the one hand, yes, we must be aware of that. And we must realize that we know very little about what lower classes of men even actually had as ideology about sex. And I think, that is important if we think about the class structure now. Like, what is the ideal masculinity among blue-collar workers, white-collar workers, rich men, sports, the sports millionaires? Like, there are different ideals of masculinity among executive lawyers compared to military or whatever, right? Like different groups of people have different masculinities, different ideas of gender and sex. And if we only have literature from one group of them, it's not reflective of the whole society. So that is a trap that we can fall into very frequently. And sometimes just scholars do it just because we sort of know that. And so we forget to say that a lot. You know, we say Romans think X. What we really mean is that problem of chronology I said earlier, but what we really mean is like this very small 1% of Roman men who were free and rich and came from upper class families probably thought X.
Yeah.
We just don't say it every time. but it is important. And I think we really do need to assume that, you know, we know that we get a little bit more of that in, say, Athens because of the radical democracy. We get a little bit of mixing in a way that we don't get elsewhere, where we can see, for instance, that it's been argued that pederasty, well, and it's been argued and I think is generally accepted, that pederasty in this form that we hear about it, the idealized, like, upper class man has a pederastic relationship with a teenage boy and is both sexually involved with him, but also is mentoring him and bringing him into society and giving it, it's an educational connection, that was highly approved of among elite, but either mocked or disapproved of by a fair proportion of the lower classes. We get indications of that from time to time in Athens. So there we have like a really foundational and important way of doing sex that not everybody in the society has the same opinions about. And so we can assume that that's going on at Rome, but we can't always access it necessarily.
Okay. Yeah, because I read an article, again, researching for this, describing masculinity in Catullus and Plautus. I can't
Plautus.
Pronounce that.
Plautus. Yeah.
The author wrote that Catullus understands that the most effective way to insult an enemy is by means of attacking his sexuality. And we did know that in Roman, the Romans didn't seem to stigmatize homosexuality and homosexual acts in themselves, as long as, you know, the partner wasn't a freeborn citizen, as long as one was passive, like it was, if you were active rather than passive.
Yes.
And is this because to Romans, sexual penetration and physical abuse are both seen as potentially violent offenses? So to be the passive one is having violence being done to you.
Sort of. I've answered a lot of your questions with sort of, haven't I?
They're That's all right.
They're good questions, which means that they have complicated answers. And so let me unpick a couple of things there.
That's all right. This is just the shit I think about. I'm like, oh.
No, exactly.
I wonder if this means that.
Yeah, and it's great because it gives me a lot to think about in response. So one thing, when we say Catullus is attacking other people's sexuality, when you say that now, you almost, just because of the way the world is right now, you usually mean homophobes attacking homosexual people. Like, realistically, that's what that's a shorthand for. When Catullus is attacking other people's sexuality, what he's doing is he's saying, this man does not perform sexuality correctly. So you are correct that axis isn't the same. So when he says, like, he's not going, haha, you're gay, right? Because that wouldn't make any sense to him for a whole set of reasons. What he's doing is he's saying, ha ha, you do sex wrong and therefore are a bad man. And because the way you do sex reflects on your masculinity reflects on your status as a Roman. Your status as a Roman is the only thing that matters in the world, right? So it's a sort of straightforward, and that's why the article you read said that attacking your sexuality is the easiest way to attack someone, because you know, it's easy to say because it's very hard to prove what sexual activities people get up to. So innuendo and just flat out lying is a good form of invective. That's why people use it now. What that means, though, what does it mean to do sexuality incorrectly is slightly different. So no, the Romans don't have that same pederastic relationship that model that I just talked about in Athens. They don't have that freeborn men taking both sides of the relationship in a kind of ongoing way. They don't do that. But they do assume that young boys are sexually attractive, that prepubescent boys are sexually attractive to normal men. So that's normative. It is a normal state of affairs. However, as you say, being the passive recipient of penetrative sex, if you are male, is shameful, in various cases causes you to lose legal status, so that you might not even be considered a Roman citizen anymore. You might lose the right to vote or various things, and definitely bad. That's doing sexuality wrong. It's bad if you're a young boy. It's even worse if you're an adult male who's having that done to you. So if you are a normal Roman and you're going to do something that's not illegal or considered immoral, when you have sex with boys, they will be enslaved boys, right? Sorry, this is distasteful is not quite the right word for it, but you know, this is an unfortunate truth about a situation that's not good. Because that's fine, you're not debauching the young boy because he's already a slave, he has no status, he has no rights, he has no physical control over his body. But there's other things that Catullus accuses people of doing. He accuses them of being excessive in their sexuality, having too much sex with too many people. And that is unmasculine because at bottom, Roman masculinity is about control. It's about control over yourself. And it's about control over others. So if you have too much sex, that shows that you cannot control yourself. And to have lack of control is womanish and raw and Roman, either both. Women were conceived of as being sort of inordinately lustful and unable to control themselves.
Naturally.
Of course. And yeah, we're either prudes or whores. There's really no, yeah. there's no option. So Catullus accuses a whole bunch of people, like Caesar at one point, for instance, and Pompey, of being adulterers and of going around and having sex with other people's wives and of having too much sex and being controlled by their lust. So that's one of the ways he attacks their sexuality. Then he attacks a bunch of other people for liking having it up the butt, for enjoying, not just being penetrated, but enjoying being penetrated, which is like as bad as it can get. So he attacks people for that. And then he also attacks people for incest. He has a bunch of people he doesn't like who he says they're having sex with their uncles or their, so incest and male, or in general, in fact. And then there's that one that I mentioned of the guy who likes to suck himself off.
Do you know what it sounds like? It sounds like at a football or soccer game.
Yeah.
When you're just throwing insults. Yeah. I say you, like.
Yeah, people do. One does.
People
yes.
are throwing insults at the other yeah. teams.
And just sort of whatever sticks, right? Like if somebody yeah. blushes, you're like, aha, go for that one. But otherwise it's nobody. And like Catullus's poetry, there are names in there that are probably real people, almost certainly were real people. And some of the poems are terrible at what they say the people do. But I don't, like, that doesn't mean those people are doing it, nor does it mean that anyone believed they were, right? Yeah. Like, we don't yeah. have to assume that anyone took these things seriously. That said, it's still an insult. And the reason I think, so when you cut, the other question you asked about, like, why is that passivity such a bad thing? Hmm. I don't think it's so much about the violence, though it certainly was, could be considered violence. I think it's basically the point that you lose your masculinity, because if you cannot control your own body and where the borders of your body are, that makes you not only not male, because what is a woman except defined by the fact that she is penetrated, right? That she is, and not in control of her own body. And I swear to God, I'm not trying to make this about like today's politics, but sometimes yeah. it's really hard for the things that come out of my mouth not to sound like I'm commenting on today's politics. But a woman, by definition, does not have control of her own body. She is penetrated by a man. She is penetrated by a man. She bears a child within her who isn't her own and that she can't control, and then comes out of her in an uncontrolled fashion. Her blood flows out of her and she doesn't have control over that. She is, you know, she is porous in a way that a man isn't. A man has control over all of his bodily appetites. He controls everything. This is like ideological, not real, yeah. just for the record. And importantly, the same is true of enslaved people. Enslaved people do not control who touches them. They do not control what is done with their body. They don't control what they do with their body. They have to do the work they're told. They're beaten. They are used for sex. They are forced to bear children that they don't want to bear. You know, all of those things. It is, in fact, the defining characteristic of an enslaved person that they don't have control over their own body. So you have to be the opposite of that to be a Roman man, a free Roman man. And so being penetrated is a reversal of that control. And so that's why I think there's so much ideological weight. Now, does that mean that every single Roman man actually thought of it as shameful, that there weren't guys who liked being bottoms, that there wasn't all of that going on? Of course not. I'm talking about like full-on focused ideological premise here, not the way people actually acted, lived their lives, which are always complicated and interesting and fun and paradoxical and weird and, you know, all those things. We just don't always have great examples of it in our sources.
Well, with all of this and all of our conversations today, how much use is it to look at this stuff with a modern eye?
It depends. No, it depends what you mean by use, I guess.
Yeah.
To be annoying. You know, what is your purpose? If you want to know how Romans thought about the world in their own, you know, what was a Roman's eye perspective of the world, then not always. It's not always useful to have a modern lens, except that people are not good at knowing what they're thinking. People are not good at, like, you know, why does therapy exist? Well, it's because we don't always understand our own brains, and we don't always understand what we really want, and we don't always know why we do the things we do. In fact, I would say that 90% of us don't know why we do the things we do most of the time, and I, anyway, am fairly fixated on never learning. I never want to know why I do most of what I do. Sounds very scary. So if you want to think about why people did stuff, you do need to listen to why they say they do it. Course, and that you have to take that seriously. I don't know Cicero better than Cicero knows Cicero. I don't know Rome better than Cicero knows Rome. On the other hand, what Cicero takes for granted that is different in my world is a place of slippage where I can see, because what the hardest thing for us to do, and go back to therapy, the hardest thing for us to do is to recognize something that we think is so normal and so regular that it is the way the world is. We never question why it happens. We never question why we do it. We never think about it because, like, so why did you get up and breathe this morning?
Mm. Well,
mostly because my body would die without it. Well, it's just so normal. Nobody says, why do you breathe? But, you know, there's lots of things we do every day. Why do I eat cereal for breakfast and not noodle soup? Well, I'll never ask that question until I meet somebody who eats noodle soup for breakfast, at which point it'll be like, oh, I wonder if there's a reason I eat cereal for breakfast. I don't eat cereal for breakfast, for the record. I eat granola bars. Totally different. But, you know, those, you know, that's the value of looking at the past, but it's also the value of taking our present perspective into the past and saying, well, the Romans do a whole bunch of things and they think they're the only way to do it because that's how they do it. And when we have a modern perspective, it gives us a little chink to kind of push into the lives they live and say, well, but there must be a reason why they do that because I don't do that. So there's got to be a reason. So now let's try to pull that out. Can we use these sources to find it? All of those things need to be done with care and with intentionality and with transparency. You need to say, hey, I'm going to talk about the ancient world using queer theory. They didn't know the word queer because they spoke Latin, among other things, but also because, you know, there's a whole 2000 years of context that they need to be able to understand that word in this sense. But that doesn't mean I can't use this approach, but I'm going to tell you I'm using it and I'm going to think consciously about using it. I'm not just going to assume this is the only answer or this is just natural either. I have to be as intentional on my side. So I think that's useful. And I also think that if your intent is to learn about the modern world, which frankly, I think that a lot of our study of the ancient world, one way or another, is also to learn about the modern world, then it's very useful to use a modern lens because then you're doing that same job, but in reverse, and you really want to be able to think about it. Yeah. So it depends what you want to do, but I think most of the time it's useful.
Thank you so much for coming to talk to me today. It's been so interesting. And if someone was to start reading around some of the stories that they know, where would you recommend being a good place to start?
So it depends a little if you mean ancient sources or modern. If you're interested in ancient sexuality, and you want to look at some of the sources for such things, and you want good stories, Suetonius is great. don't believe a word the man says, but his Lives of the Emperors, the Lives of the Caesars, so much fun, so scandalous, completely nuts, but I love it. So that's Suetonius's 12 Caesars. Cicero's Philippics, this is going to sound a bit weird, but his speech is attacking Mark Antony right after Julius Caesar's death, are scurrilous. The things he says about Mark Antony, I mean, you really do understand why Fulvia wanted his tongue stabbed through. And it's, as I said, I find invective a great place to look for this. Catullus, of course, which we already talked about, all of Catullus' poems are nice and easy and simple for the most part. They read well in translation, and they're dirty as all get out. They're great. Not all of them, but the best ones are. Juvenal is the other poet I would point you to now, but with a warning. Catullus is aggressive and sometimes violent, and that is something to keep in mind. Juvenal is truly horrible. Like, he writes these satires, and there's one that's about women, and he just goes through all the horrible things that women are. It's misogyny for hundreds of lines. It's fascinating, and it's a really good source, because as I said, like, insults tell you norms. So it's a really good and useful source. It's awful, though. He's a horrible person, or at least the depiction he is. Like, it's really, don't read it when you're feeling down on the world. There's lots of straightforward homophobia, within the Roman context of what that means, stuff that you could certainly read as transphobia in the sense that it's about like feminized men being the worst thing that could happen to the entire world. You know, people who dress like in a womanish manner and stuff like that. It's not directly trans, but it's, you know, it could be a hard thing to read if you were in a particular place. So basically I'm giving a warning. Juvenal's really interesting, gives you a lot of information, but it's a hard read. Like, I'm pretty inured to some of this stuff, and I'm not all in a vulnerable place identity-wise for most of it, and I still find some of it hard. So just a bit of a warning. There's a world of secondary literature out there, and I don't want to point you to too much really scholarly stuff, but I want to mention two recent, like, if you look Google sort of sex in antiquity or sex in the Roman world or Roman sexuality, you'll find some really good companion books out there. But I want to mention two books that are kind of new just because I think they're really interesting. And one of them is called Exploring Gender Diversity in the Ancient World. And it's got books, chapters on sort of trans-identified people and gender non-binary people within the context of the ancient world and attitudes towards them and towards bodies and body changing and things like that. So that's one, it's a collection of chapters.
And who's the other, by, or who's it published by?
Oh, sorry. It's published by the University of Edinburgh Press, and it's edited by Alison Surtees and Jennifer Dyer. And I'll send you the info have the information. And then the other one is it's quite recent. It's called this is about Greece, not about Rome. It's got Rome stuff in it too, but Performing the Kynaidos, Unmanly Men in Ancient Mediterranean Cultures.
Okay.
Kynaidos is this really interesting figure. It's basically a man who enjoys being passive. And it's a slur. It's an insult. But it's also, there's some suggestion that there might have been people who actually self-identified that way and were interested in being that as a subculture. That's pushing our evidence, but it's not impossible. And that's by Tom Sapsford, and it's from Oxford University Press. So I will send you those information if you want to post it. But yeah, they're very recent books that I have found really interesting, and they're sort of go beyond the basic information about how sex and sexuality worked to start thinking about some of the less mainstream elements, sort of people who were more marginalized in the ancient world too.
They sound really interesting. Yeah, I'll definitely post about them. What is your favorite classics inspired art? It could be a painting, a sculpture, it could be an opera, a play, a poem.
I'm gonna go for poems because that's my thing, and I'm gonna say two.
Yeah, sure.
You can cut one out if it's too much.
No.
Because one of them is I don't know, I find this poem I find it cute isn't the right word, but like kind of endearing. That would be the word. It's a quite a famous poem. It's by Yeats. It's The Scholars. And if you'll indulge me, I could read it because it's quite short. If I can open the right window on my computer, because I'm apparently not able to. The Scholars by W.B. Yeats. Bald heads forgetful of their sins, old, learned, respectable bald heads edit and annotate the lines that young men, tossing on their beds, rhymed out in love's despair to flatter beauty's ignorant ear. All shuffle there, all cough in ink, all wear the carpet with their shoes, all think what other people think, all know the man their neighbor knows. Lord, what would they say did their Catullus walk that way? That's it.
Got to get the name check in of the Catullus.
Yeah, it's, as I said. And the funny thing is that I have my reservations about that idea of Catullus as being just like this sincere young man and full of the passion of love and joy. I talked before about how I don't really believe quite in that vision of poetry as like the romantic notion of poetry as the outpourings of the soul. Mm-hmm. But that said, I still love it's just a good poem. And the other one, if you'll indulge me again, is a personal connection, because I said my mom is a poet, and she, her name is Susan McMaster, and I won't read this whole one because it's too long, but she has a poem in one of her earlier works called Pandora, and it's one of my favorite versions of the Pandora story. And I'll just read a little bit of it just to kind of give you a sense of it. It was that one moment, my hand on the jar in the morning kitchen, the thumb edged with garden earth, rubbing its mound against the lid. You all blame me. You think I had a choice to bring out the jar or leave it locked in the cupboard by the door till time had wound us back to the start. You say I was careless or foolish or wicked or simply curious, that sin you call women's. That sin you call woman's. As if men weren't the ones always probing and prying and lifting up stones. But you don't understand. And then she goes on to say, I was left alone and I was bored and I had nothing else to do. And not every sin was sealed away. Curiosity was still out there. And then it ends with boredom. That's all. Such a small and simple sin to topple a world. And my right hand, four fingers, one thumb, one hand that came to twitch and burn, to clench in the night, to jerk against a glass, send it crashing to the floor. And one day, when the sun shone in, pulled me to the cupboard, turned the cool key, lifted out the jar. What else could I have done?
That's really cool. And where can people find that? Is that in an anthology?
It's in a book that's not The Life of a Poet is to go out of print fairly quickly. So, but I'll give you a link to the work. It's Susan McMaster, and you can find other work of hers online, but I'll ask her. She almost always lets me. I can send you the whole poem.
Oh, that would be amazing.
Put it up if that would be okay. It's not hugely longer than that. I just don't want to keep you too long, but I've always enjoyed that. And I've also always been proud of her that in spite of the fact I was a small child at the time when she wrote that and I couldn't correct her, she knew it was a jar.
The jar, yes. I thought that when you read it out.
A jar, yeah. And I was like, oh, even before I was there to be pedantic, you were pedantic on my behalf. Thank you.
Well, we've got to rep the mummers. So
exactly.
We've got two last questions, but one last question before we talk about you is what do you think could be done to make classics more inclusive? Obviously, it's notoriously white,
not
cis men mm-hmm. of a certain class level.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there are many things because there are many problems, right? In some ways it is easy to say what makes it more inclusive because there are so many ways in which it is exclusive. But there is also a ton of work being done, and I don't think we need to be despairing about it necessarily. That said, if I was going to say a few things that would make it, you know, I could talk about stuff about language learning and things, but in a more broad sense, I think one of the big things to do when talking about classics is to really interrogate your use of the word we. We do this and they did that, because who is the we? And I probably did it today because it's such a habit. It's so hard to fall out of. But whenever we talk about classics and we talk about we think this, the we there is a very specific European, North American person from a particular background who has a particular attitude and experiences and language and all the rest of it. And the minute we do that and we talk about we, you know, the Romans did this and we do this and this is why we, and we got our life from the Romans, you know, all it claims, it stakes a claim to the ancient world, it assumes a continuity that may or may not be there, but even if it's there, it's not an exclusive continuity. And it puts an ownership on the discussion of the ancient world. If you don't stand in this position with us, then you are not in this conversation with the ancient world in the same way. And that's a sort of an ideological one rather than a like nuts and bolts kind of answer. I'm no longer in the field, so I'm a little less able to feel like I can talk about what the levers are of how to yeah. change. And it's different in every country. The problems that keep people out of the field in some ways are wide, but the true everywhere, but in other ways, they're very particular to the context of the specific educational institutions, et cetera, et cetera. But I think if we can think harder about who we is and talk and be more explicit about modern North American middle-class people think X or whatever we actually mean, or in fact, I, because most of the time it's when I say we, what I really mean is I think this. So why not just admit it? I think that's maybe helps position you to notice other gaps, to notice who's not being, when you have to say middle-class white North American people think 80 times instead of we, maybe you notice that you never say anything except that. that I think in and of itself can help you notice other problems.
Yeah, I agree with you there. And the last question is, where can people go to support you online, find out about your podcast?
So the easiest place to go is to the website www.alliterative.net, alliterative like things that alliterate. That is where the videos that my husband and I make, which is on a YouTube channel called Alliterative, with a series called The Endless Knot. We make our YouTube videos. You can find information there. You can find about pages for me and for him. His name is Mark Sundaram. And we do a podcast, and you can find information there, The Endless Knot podcast, which is about etymology, but all it's about connections. And we made it that theme because it meant we could do anything we wanted. So we talk about etymology most of the time is part of what we talk about, but he's a medievalist, I'm a classicist, so we talk about the medieval English world and classical world and pop culture, and we talk to interesting people because they're interesting, and we do interviews, so there's a lot of different things covered, but a lot of focus on language, and you can find information there. And then I'm also Aven Sarah, so AvenSarah on Twitter, and in spite of the fact that that is a dying space, I am clinging onto it with my fingernails because many of my communities are there, and I am disgustingly present. So if you want to reach me, that's always the best way to do so.
We'll put all of that in our episode description.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thanks for hanging out with me today. And again, special thanks to Aven. Follow us on Instagram at Demythifying the Podcast for more episodes. And if you're liking what we're doing, please rate, subscribe and share. Check out our website at www.demythpod.co.uk. I've been Charlotte, and today I've been joined by Dr. Aven McMaster.